Hello and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I am Tyler Smith.
I am David Bax.
And thank you for listening. David.
Yes.
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. We don't have time to waste because we have a guest and we have multiple things we want to talk about. So I will jump right in first by mentioning our sponsor. I want to tell you about tweakedaudio.com. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. Tyler and I use them each and every day of our lives. I'm using them at this moment. This morning I was using them. I don't know. Tyler, I know you're somewhat of a jazz guy. Mm-hmm. Like I am. I don't know if you're aware that there's a live performance of John Coltrane's A Love Supreme that we didn't know existed on tape.
Oh,
was recently discovered and remastered. And I think has come out just a few days ago. I was listening to A Love Supreme on my earbuds, my tweakedaudio.com earbuds. It sounded great. It could sound great for you as well. You can find these earbuds at a low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Tyler?
Yes?
We have a guest. Who is our guest?
Oh, my gosh. I don't remember when he was last on the show proper. He's been on a couple of commentaries, and obviously that's been a while. Yeah. But it's a filmmaker and just all around great guy, in my opinion. I love talking to him. He's always so upbeat. He always elevates. I wasn't even trying to do that. Always elevates my mood. It's Dallas Hallam. Dallas, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for that too kind introduction. I appreciate it.
I probably should have focused more on you as a filmmaker. Like, you know, we don't have people on the show just because they're like nice. Maybe we should do that more often.
Yeah, I'm happy to be known as a super nice, as a magnetically nice guy.
Well, I'm also realizing
let's not go too far.
We've known you almost 10 years now. Mm-hmm. Because I know I met you, Dallas, if I'm remembering correctly, I met you on the rooftop bar of the Downtown Independent during mm-hmm. LA Film Fest 2012. Is that right?
Yes. And would that have been in November?
I think LA Film Fest doesn't exist anymore, but I think at this time it was still during the summer, I want to say. Was it June? Oh, okay.
Well, that would have been 10 years ago then.
Because this coming June, 10 years.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And I remember, my wife and I had just seen Entrance. We weren't even married yet, but we talked to you, and then we mentioned we were planning to go get sushi in Little Tokyo, and I think you recommended a place. Does that sound right?
That does sound right. I have a terrible memory, so I can't remember what place I recommended. I do remember that my wife and I, or at the time she was my wife, and my wife and I were big, we loved going to eat sushi, so I'm sure I had a recommendation.
Yeah. So that's almost 10 years since that conversation.
Yes, and I was a fan prior. I was already a listener. I'd been a listener for a few years. I believe I was a listener because I'm also friends with show regular Josh Fadum.
Yeah.
But and that's how we met. I think Josh connected us, but I was already a listener. An old friend of mine named John Damer introduced me to the show. Way back when I was first getting into listening to podcasts.
I hope John's still listening. Thanks, John.
Yes, thank you, John. but you know what? I get it if he doesn't. Like, we've been doing this for a long time.
Been a long time.
After a certain point, here's a thought. I feel like at this point, now, not just because I'm friends with David, but also just doing this for a long enough time, you kind of feel like you know what someone's going to say about a specific movie. Every once in a while, David will surprise me. And I'm sure every once in a while, I'll surprise him with like liking something or not liking something. But for the most part, I imagine longtime listeners like, yeah, I think I got it.
Yeah. The last time I remember, and this is, I remember you surprising me. It delights me when you surprise me.
Yeah.
You, if I, as I recall, hate, you finally caught up with one of my favorite romantic comedies of all time, My Best Friend's Wedding, yeah. And you hated it. And I was like weirdly over the moon about the fact that you hated it, because it's like, oh, we get to disagree about something.
Yeah, it's definitely, I don't know if I so much hated it as I just, it's tough because that main character is such a sociopath, as so many of those characters sort of have to be to make things happen. Mm-hmm. But it's hard for me to find her charming when that is happening. But yeah, I was catching up on some Julia Roberts movies. I did enjoy Notting Hill, which I don't remember if you liked that one.
I'm not a big Notting Hill guy, but I probably need to rewatch it.
Yeah, it's pretty solid. Yeah.
RIP to Roger Michel, director of Notting
Indeed,
Hill.
Indeed.
Yeah, speaking of directors, ones that are still with us, Dallas, you've been making films for a while, and we wanted to switch gears before we get into, as you probably noticed from the spooky theme music, this is our annual Halloween episode, but first we did want to switch gears to something more serious and talk about what's going on, what's dominating sort of film industry headlines over the past, I guess, like 3 or 4 days, which is the tragic accidental death of a cinematographer on the set of a New Mexico shot Western called Rust. I was telling you guys, we started talking about this off mic and then we were like, let's, you know, we have plenty to say. I have been for some reason just like fixated on this story, just like consuming every sort of article that I can read. And a part of that is just like this need on my part to like understand how this could happen, because my understanding, which has been solidified actually by reading the things, is that there are a lot of things in place on movie sets to keep this sort of thing from happening. And so I've been, I think, just pouring through all of these reports, trying to figure out what went wrong at which stage or stages and which person or people didn't do their task. But I've, you know, I've never been, I was a PA when I first moved out here. I've never been on a set that had guns going off. Dallas, you're a director of work on sets. Have you ever worked around firearms?
Yes. In fact, I am officially a member of Local 44, which is props, and that's for the I believe that covers 44. Okay. If I'm wrong about that, I apologize for most of my guns and a lot of gun stuff.
I don't know what has been your response to read about this story, like,
yeah, it's terrible. It's just an awful thing to happen. And what I'm trying to do right now is not is just it's so easy to jump to conclusions by reading a few things. And I'm just really trying to let the information come out. So, for example, the first thing that I don't even know is if correct me if new information has come out, but if these were in fact live rounds or if there was something else.
We don't know. I don't think the public at large at this point doesn't know. Yeah. Most of what I've read has been from legitimate news sources. There are rumors that have been on TMZ that I'm not going to address, in regards to that. We'll see what comes out, but we don't know what the gun was loaded with. We know obviously there was something either in, the chamber or in the barrel. But we also know that when Alec Baldwin, who was the one who accidentally discharged the gun, we know from multiple sources that he was told it was a quote unquote cold gun at the time that it was handed to him by the AD.
So the reason I mentioned that is it makes a difference. Although I guess at the end of the day, this is a systemic failure more than a singular person's responsibility, failing, but, in the case of Brandon Lee, it took years to fully understand that story, and that there was a projectile, a bullet minus its shell, stuck in the chamber of a gun, and then a blank, when the blank was fired, it actually pushed the bullet that was stuck in the chamber out of the gun and shot him. So, and that was another example of a systemic failure that was a failure of dominoes falling over the course of many people and the gun moving from different locations.
Yeah.
So I've given this particular tragedy a good bit of thought. And I guess, you know, from my perspective, the blame lies on the culture of the set. Each movie, it has its own culture. It's a business that starts up and it runs really fast and then it shuts down. And within that singular business, it has its own culture. And that culture is created from the top. The producers that are there create that culture. And then the first AD, who is getting a lot of heat on this one, is the bridge between the producers and everybody else. So in this case, we have questions about the armorer. I know 44 has said that there wasn't a representative from 44 on set. I don't know if that's helpful or damning. I mean, why wasn't the representative on set? And so that there could have been many reasons for that. The person may not have known the weapons were there, but again, that's also kind of damning. The next stage of that is why was the first AD even touching the weapon? So that should never have happened. And then declaring it cold clearly didn't even look into the weapon, mm-hmm. but declaring it cold is kind of beside the fact that first that he should not have even been touching it. And then at that moment where it was passed to Alec Baldwin should have looked into the gun. Now I'm not blaming Alec Baldwin. I'm just trying to point out this is a systemic issue where there were faults at every link on the chain leading up to the horrific tragedy.
Yeah, I think go ahead, Tyler.
Well, and it does sound, and it's tough, like in a way it almost sounds like gossip, but of course it's the nature of this story. Like you hear about the environment of the set, and it sounded like, I mean, obviously it's a low budget movie anyway. Not that that necessarily excuses anything, but you also hear that like crew members were extremely unhappy just in general, like just, it was not a very positive place to be. And so right. You wonder if just in that spirit of people just were not putting a great deal of effort into their specific jobs or not communicating the way they should have been otherwise. And mm-hmm. it just sounds like such a, I remember, I forget what article I was reading, but it said like, it's obviously this is a horrible thing no matter what, but there's just something about like, somebody dying on the set of a movie that they don't really want to be a part of at a time when it's pretty miserable to be there anyway. And this is what happens. And so, yeah, it just sounds, I mean, on every possible level, it just sounds like such a horrible thing. But I'm sorry, David, you go ahead.
Well, a couple of things. I'm glad you mentioned the culture, because I think there's an instinct maybe on certain people's parts, and I kind of had it too, to read stories about like the camera crew walking off set that morning and being replaced that day. And there's a part of you saying like, well, that's awful, but this wasn't the camera crew's fault. But it speaks to what you're saying, Dallas, that there is a culture. There are reports that this wasn't the first accidental discharge on the set of Rust. So this is clearly something ongoing. And it gets to the thing that I think at first my impetus for like wanting to read so much about this was me thinking, what does the industry need to put in place to keep this from happening in the future? And what I'm sort of realizing, it's like, well, protocols are in place to keep this from happening. It's all there. Now it's like, well, what do we need to do to make sure those protocols are followed?
So I've worked with many armorers that take their job very seriously. And so I don't know this armorer, and I don't want to speculate that the protocols are in place. I left out one fault, and that one bit of fault is their live round even on set. So that's a whole nother question. Were these guns taken out after hours and for fun? Were people out doing some target practice with these weapons? But live rounds should not have been near the set to begin with, entered by an armorer. Then you've got the first AD touching the guns when they shouldn't. And then you've got Alec Baldwin, who should have been more aware of the safety of being handed a gun, regardless of what he was told. I mean, I've seen guns passed to actors the proper ways. The armorer opens up the weapon. We look in the first AD looks inside. Then the first AD says, okay, now armorer, take the gun over to the actor. The actor looks inside. There's many steps. And so those, the cultures have to change, but the protocols are already there.
I was recently, as I tend to do, because I love this Blu-ray set so much and I find it oddly comforting. I was rewatching the making of the Alien anthology. And, you know, I was watching interviews with like Gail Ann Hurd, the producer of Aliens, and they talked about some of the stuff that was happening that had happened on set. Like, just, you know, you're dealing with big equipment, you're dealing with explosions and fire and guns and all that sort of thing. And it was something that she said that also reminds me of something that we once heard Richard Donner say in an interview about The Omen. Which she's like, she goes, you know, when it comes right down to it, we are just making a movie, and it's just not worth anybody getting hurt and certainly killed for. And I think it's possible, because I also, our friend Eric 13 tweeted about this, and he had said that he was directing a short film that involved a gun, and he wanted to, and he was a real stickler about like the rules. And he said he got sort of treated, even as the director, as sort of a wet blanket by various people on set, including the producer. And so I do think that, like, because it's life and death for, because like, obviously this is people's job and they take it very seriously. And so in a way it's almost like, yes, but this is, you know, we're doing something really important. He's like, yes, you obviously are making a living and you're creating art and all that. But when it comes right down to it, it is just a movie. Mm-hmm. And just because, like, yes, this is art and you are being creative, but there is, there's technology behind it and there is a lot of work that has to go into it. And so the idea that any set, whether it be a big budget or small budget, whatever it is, that people would like ignore these important protocols, like that, if it were a construction site, of course people would observe it. But because it's a movie, you do sort of wonder, again, I guess going back to this idea of the culture of a particular set, if people just aren't taking it that seriously, because it's just like, well, on one hand, maybe they're like, well, we're just making a movie. People don't get killed during movies. They get killed in the movie, but that's it. But yeah, like, it is a job like any other, and that people can get actually hurt and actually mm-hmm. killed. And so I do wonder if, as you said, like, the protocols are there, and hopefully, you know, thankfully this is something we don't hear about that often, but we do hear about it enough. Whether it be like the death of Vic Morrow and various others and Brandon Lee and all these other things that happen on set. And hopefully it's something we don't hear about for a long time, because this is getting so much press that every film production from the top down, whether it be huge or very small, is like, okay, well, obviously this is a very serious thing that can happen, and no movie is worth this kind of, you know, casual attitude. So let's like really take it seriously. I mean, obviously it's unfortunate that somebody would have to die for that to happen, but at the same time, it's, if there's anything potentially quote unquote good that could come out of it, it's the, like, maybe, just maybe, this will be the last time this happens.
Right. Right.
And we should move on to our topic. We've talked about this whole thing without actually saying the name of the woman who died.
Her
cinematographer's name is Helena Hutchins, I think is how you say her first name. And it's a terrible loss. She was by all accounts very well respected and had quite a career in front of her, and has a loving family and son.
Yeah.
So definitely my thoughts go out to the Hutchins family.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that was heavy, but let's get into it again. Let's get into it, shall we? It's our horror episode.
Okay.
So we're going to freak each other out with tales of of arrogance and condescension yes. as we unpack the term.
But who's arrogance and condescension? We'll that's what'll be interesting to see as we go forward.
As we unpack the term elevated horror and what that represents, what it says about the movies that are described that way, and maybe I'm tipping my hat towards where I'm leaning, what it says about the type of people who describe movies that way. But Tyler, yeah, this is your idea.
I think because the concept is something I wasn't really super aware of. I think you had told, because you're David, you're more tuned into like film Twitter than I am.
I know, and we say film Twitter as sort of like a metonym or a stand-in for like just the discourse. So like,
yeah.
This is like, so sometimes I use film Twitter to talk about like people getting obsessed with things that aren't important, but sometimes sure. the actual discourse is happening on Twitter.
Wait, yeah, real quick. And at the risk of sounding just like a 50, 60 year old man, I've never quite understood what is meant by film Twitter. Is that just people on Twitter who are discussing films, or is there like a subsection that can be joined? I'm sorry, it seems so old.
No, there's not like an official thing you can join. It's just that because the way that algorithms work, you tend to self-select your own
bubble
on Twitter. So like I tend to like basically get filmed when I read my Twitter feed in order. It's usually about movies or it's about hockey. Occasionally it's also about politics, because all of Twitter is always about politics, but it's like usually movie people or hockey people tweeting about politics, you know? And then occasionally I get like lacrosse tweets, because if you follow women's hockey, like writers, unfortunately there's not a lot of people are making a full-time living writing about women's hockey. So you tend to also get like weird other like niche sports. So I get like a weird amount of lacrosse, like pro lacrosse and college lacrosse tweets during those seasons. And I just sort of scroll right past them. But anyway, you sort of self-select your bubble. So like we did a whole episode, this was like 2018, I think, about the idea of film Twitter and how it's not actually that useful a term, because like there's like art house film Twitter and there's like people, you know, MCU film Twitter or whatever, you know. Last night scrolling through Twitter, it was like everything was either about the new NHL team, the Seattle Kraken, or about Dune. Like it was just like one going back and forth, like, oh, the Kraken are off to a good start. Okay, I thought Dune was okay. Like that's all of my tweets. But anyway, so yeah, film Twitter is not a set in stone thing. But it's just a shorthand of talking about like the online film conversation, I guess.
Yeah. I should be part of it, given what I do. But at the same time, I tried it for like a few months ago. I tried it for about 2 days. I followed a lot and I was like, all right, I'm going to plug in. This is my community. And after 2 days, I was like
really do wow, Twitter.
This is exhausting. I can't do this.
Yeah. Every two or three years, I'll re-download Twitter and kind of try it out. And it's just at a point where I just, it's just too much effort.
Yeah. I wish I could quit it. Yeah. It's so reductive.
Just the whole internet is just a pain in the butt, man. Anything I've found. So I do a lot of Patreon subscriptions. And so I found when a Patreon subscription, sometimes will automatically drop you into a Discord server. And at those times, those are great. There's something about the fact that everybody's paid a little bit of money, put a little bit of effort into being there, that really changes the vibe on something. So yeah. I do a good bit of Discord, but if I go on to anything else, I'm very hesitant to make any sort of comment on anything, or because I just the language is so it's a different language at this point, and I don't know how to speak it.
Yeah, I think you're probably better off as a result. Yeah. David is the one taking the hit for me and for Battleship Pretension, and I very much appreciate it. He's plugged in, and this is what I'm talking about, is that like the idea of elevate, like once David had told me like what people mean by that, it's like, oh no, I totally get it. I totally understand what people are talking about. I don't agree at all. I think it's a very much the wrong kind of conversation. But I also understand like,
you know, people talking about sort of this horror renaissance of the last 10 to 15 years, with films like The Witch, or Midsommar, or Hereditary, you know, just sort of, or frankly, I would include, obviously it wasn't a big movie, but I would include Entrance, like these kind of the slow burn horror movies. And I think people see that and they see like, oh, this is something a little bit different. Granted, there are movies, there have been movies like that in the past, but like, this is something a little bit different, and it's different than my, in my opinion, reductive definition of horror. And so this is something I can finally at long last take more seriously, as though horror itself is not inherently artistic.
Well, this is,
I'm tipping my hand as well, by the way.
Yeah. But okay, so to give my understanding of the sort of the history of the term, I think you're right. Talking about things like Entrance or like House of the Devil, and like the early 2010s, there was this bubbling up of a certain type of slow burn.
And they used to be called horror. Mumble gore, which mumble thank gore, God yeah. that just, that didn't stick, or that left, whichever, but thankfully that's not a thing.
But then I think what happened in 2014 and 2015 is two movies, not movies I would consider mainstream movies, but got enough attention to sort of bubble up into the mainstream, are It Follows and, as Tyler mentioned, The Witch. And I think those movies garnered enough attention that people outside of the indie horror world, or people who didn't have the pulse on indie horror, were taking account of that. And also The Babadook is another one, I think, that and what year is that? Also 2015?
14.
Okay, so It Follows and The Babadook and The Witch. 2014, 2015.
When was Hereditary?
Well, see, I think that's after this has been established.
Okay, so
Yeah, I think...
I feel like Hereditary sealed the deal. With whatever this so-called elevated horror is, Hereditary kind of iced the cake there.
Yeah, and well, because Hereditary is 2018. I don't know if people consider Get Out part of this. Like, is that elevated?
Some people do. I mean, so I feel like in some ways I'm unprepared for the conversation, because I really have never, it's a term I've heard in discourse, but it's not a term that I've ever, I went and Googled it, some discussions and articles and lists, but I've never really dug deep into what people are meaning by this outside of just what it seems to be on its surface. And I don't like it. I don't like the term. I'll go and put my cards on the table. I feel like we're all in the same boat on that, maybe for different reasons. I don't think it's a very good title, a very good label.
Googling the term kind of like made me realize, like, oh, this is like a tempest in a teapot situation, where there is more backlash against this term than there are people using it in earnest.
Well, that was my next question. Yeah, because you mentioned, so, you know, on film Twitter, do people use this term as in actual discourse, or do we just see this term used a lot where people are saying things like, oh God, I'm so sick of people saying elevated horror. And
it's more than
which
now.
Is actually the thing that's happening.
But it's also kind of, I do think there is still a problem of mainstream, not even mainstream audiences isn't really the problem here. I think quote unquote, like respectable bourgeois, audiences and critics still, yes, even if they're not using the term, still saying like, okay, this kind of horror, like Midsommar, like, you know, Ari Aster's movies are more respectable. They are of more worth somehow. And
it's bigger than that. Not only are they more respectable, they're unimpeachable. So I think where we start to bristle at the way these movies get discussed is that there's no room for discussion. You know, if you don't like The Witch, or I really like Midsommar, and I really like all these movies that are being discussed, or that we're going to discuss. However, there is something a little that doesn't feel quite right when cultural tastemakers pick pieces of media and then present them to the world as just completely unimpeachable. And then a term like elevated horror, what it tends to do, at least for me, is then I start to go, okay, well, what's so elevated about them? And the more I scrutinize them, now is it okay that I just run for a second? I'm sorry.
Please.
Okay. So, and I like I said, I like these movies, but this is why I don't like this term. Because what the term does is the term leads you to turn back toward the movies and ask yourself, well, are these movies wearing the Emperor's new clothes? Is a movie, I mean, how deep really is say Midsommar, you know? Now again, I like the movie. Okay. So I'm not here to say these movies aren't actually good, but the term elevated horror, it pushes your brain to start to look at them and say, well, but what is it that makes these so-called, what is it that makes these movies elevated? What does that mean? And all to my mind, what it means is that these are like the museum version of a horror movie, the New Yorker version of a horror movie. You know what I mean? Like, as opposed, but does that mean it's actually deeper? I mean, I'm not trying to throw stones here, but I mean, you may be able to have a deeper discussion about you know, bring in all kinds of things like Freud and philosophy and Marxism, and talk about things like Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2 or Sleepaway Camp, wonderful example. And I don't know that the movies that are called elevated are actually deeper than the horror movies that are that spent most of their existence being dismissed.
Yeah, I think
they don't like them. I just watched The Lighthouse, but I'm not sure that how deep The Lighthouse actually is.
But I think that's to get up on my high horse. I think to a certain superficially literate audience, they seem deeper because actually they're easier to read. Whereas something that seems to be dressed up in schlock or whatever, it might take some more mental elbow grease to say like, oh, what is this movie reflecting about the world in which it was made? Whereas in something that seems arty or thoughtful, it's more up on the surface. Like,
or how about this? It's something that's intentionally fun can't be good art, right?
Right.
And is like more easily acceptable as a work of art. Now I say all this, like, I can't stress enough how much I like these movies that are being discussed. I wouldn't put them above other horror movies that I've seen. You pull it out by itself and you say, okay, Midsommar is, instead of calling it an elevated horror film, well, it's a version of folk horror. Let's put it inside of folk horror and discuss all of folk horror, you know, or The Witch, put it inside of witch movies and talk about that, as opposed to saying, oh, The Witch is some kind of masterpiece because it's not fun to watch, which it is fun to watch, but you know what I mean.
Right. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. But it also, I think a lot of it has to do with like the cast, you know. Hereditary has like Toni Collette and Gabriel Byrne, like, you know, respectable actors, whereas like horror was a place where we did a whole episode on like the sort of, grand dame horror, like formerly respectable actresses who like later in life have to Betty Davis, Shelley Winters. Yeah. There's a lot of people like that. To go back to what your point, the example I was going to give, a movie that's super fun, super populist and mainstream, Poltergeist, one of my favorite horror movies of all time, is also an incredibly insightful movie about the sort of anxiety of like former hippies who are now like upwardly mobile, moving into the suburbs, you know, and dealing with like what of themselves remains from their younger idealism.
Right.
Like that's, that movie is such a rich text.
So it's rich. So you could bring Poltergeist in and you could talk about the Reagan years. You could talk about and just where it sits in history. You could talk about, you could bring in some sociology. You could talk about the expansion of the suburbs and urban planning, of the ways in which it's problematic, which should be problematic. And I think that's just more things to talk about, you know, the in the film, whereas some of the so-called one of the touchstones of an elevated horror film is, I think they're not going to hit any notes that are going to make it cancelable by the culture. There's just something about them that's very sterile and figured out. It's like they've figured out the right notes to play where we can't do anything but say we like these movies, which again, they're good movies, but I'm just saying it's, it is a little
that's
strange.
a that's a great point that they're weirdly like safer. These movies, which is, again, I don't want to sound like I'm ragging on these movies. I mean, I do have my problems with Hereditary. I think Midsommar is definitely an improvement on Hereditary. I love The Lighthouse.
I love The Lighthouse too, by the way. I mean, I just watched it, but I'm sorry. I keep interrupting. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. You're our guest. So, you get pride of place.
I just don't, I've been thinking about this all day because I don't want to sound like I'm ragging on these movies, but movies that have a very privileged neoliberal perspective, and they're made from that perspective, and they're made for that perspective, you know, like, you don't get it. And so I like those movies, but I like Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2 just as much.
All right. So I'm developing a theory right now. And I think David kind of mentioned it already, but essentially, like, and it, this, like yourself, it's going to sound like I'm taking a swipe at these movies. Not at all. I adore The Witch and It Follows and a lot of these. And so, as tends to happen, the way people talk about movies tends to impact it. Sometimes we get it mixed up with the films itself themselves, you know, and it's just like, I don't think Robert Eggers was just like, now it's time to really take this seriously. No, I think he was just making whatever movie he wanted to make. But I do think that, like, you get a movie, you know, you mentioned Poltergeist. I think obviously like Night of the Living Dead, it works completely on its own level, on the most superficial level. People watch it as a zombie movie and they're like, it works as a zombie movie. Now, obviously there is more going on underneath the surface, but if you wanted to only look at it in the most superficial way, it'll still work for you. Mm-hmm. And I think there are people who are suspicious of that. And they think that, like, well, no, like something like The Witch takes the outer layer and the lower level or whatever, the deeper level, and it combines the two. So that suddenly the deeper conversation is part of the superficial layer. And I think people mistake that for like, okay, well, now you can't not talk about the deeper level. Whereas with, you know, Alien or Poltergeist or Night of the Living Dead, those, like, it's the kind of thing, it goes back to something that we've talked about before, where it's like a certain type of hoity-toity person's like, well, morons are just going to watch this movie. Like, I mean, I know what Night of the Living Dead is all about, but these morons over here, they just think it's a zombie movie. But with something like The Witch, that brings this to the surface. And now the morons think it's too slow. So now now we're really going to weed out the morons from people like me. And I do feel like, I don't think this is Robert Eggers doing it. The way people talk about it is itself a way of gatekeeping and being like, no, it's Professor Frank teaching kindergarten and playing with the little corn popper thing. And he says, no. And a kid says, can I play with it? He says, no, because you won't be able to appreciate it on as many levels as I do. And that's what it reminds me of. And so,
I think that's spot on.
Thank you. It works really well. And I do think that this is something David and I, and we're not the only ones to do it, but like, we often associate horror with comedy because screaming and laughing are involuntary reactions. And it takes actually a lot to get that reaction out of somebody. And as such, you'll find just as many, like, people don't say elevated comedies, but you will see that there are those movies year to year that are perfectly good. Like the one that I usually jump to is like Sideways. I think Sideways is great. I think it's often very funny, but obviously there's a melancholy there. There's some drama there. And because of that, people feel like they can take it more seriously than a movie like, say, Airplane, which is my go-to as the funniest movie ever made. Meanwhile, and so because they can take it, because they can dissect it more overtly on like on a drama level, on a narrative level, character, whatever it is, they feel like, oh, finally, this is a comedy I can enjoy and take more seriously. And I think that there's nothing wrong with Sideways, but I think so much, like we've been talking about, so much of how people respond to it and
it just suggests like a real snobbishness towards stuff that is seen as more base, like horror, like comedy, whatever it is. And it's like drama and really delving into things. That's what we like. And anytime one of these lesser genres or categories or whatever it is can try to achieve that, now I can finally engage with, now I can finally condescend to engage with this the way I would other films.
Yes, yes, I think that's true. I think there's a snob, there's always been a snobbishness, and that this hasn't changed since, you know, since Hitchcock was complaining about it. There's a snobbishness toward, how do I say really a lot of time, great suspense movies are manipulating you, and well, all movies are manipulating you to some extent, but there's a feeling that if I'm being manipulated, that means it's not good art. That good art should be sitting flat, and I approach it and I do what I want with it. I don't let it do something to me. And a lot of the movies that we talk about as elevated horror films, not all of them, but a lot of them don't really play with the mechanics of suspense. There's a feeling that toying with the mechanics of suspense is somehow base. And so by doing this kind of more, for lack of a better word, like European art house style, that, but actually these movies are they just tend to be using things like, I mean, when you watch something like Hereditary, you know, there's just, they're wallowing in the most negative of human emotions, but they're not really working with suspense. I don't know. I don't know if the director of Hereditary would appreciate that, but I don't ever with many of these films feel Get Out would be different. I mean, that's take that off the table for a second, but a lot of these movies, they are movies that you're watching and you're really scrutinizing and you're enjoying the aesthetic qualities. There are exercises in aesthetics. And I don't mind that at all. I've often thought that, you know, I never have appreciated the insult when the idea of style over substance is lobbed at something as an insult. I mean, style is substance and style can be substance. Just look at the Neon Demon, for God's sakes. And that you don't get more substance than that. And it's just style.
That was one of my favorite movies of that year. I
fucking love that movie. Yeah. It's okay to just wallow in style, but that's what I tend to feel. Now, these movies are all very fresh. I mean, I just watched The Lighthouse. Who knows how we're going to feel in 20 years. But a lot of these movies, for me at this current moment, while there's the less than generous way to put it would be that they're collections of affectations. And I know that doesn't sound generous, but that's where my brain goes when I start to ask myself, well, what is elevated horror? I can't have, that's, you know, the term itself is pushing my brain to a place I don't want it to go, which is to say, oh, well, they're just collections of affectations. And that sounds so mean. I don't mean it to sound mean. So that term should be,
but I think, again, we're talking more, as Tyler said, we're talking more about the type of people who gravitate toward quote unquote elevator horror than we are the films themselves, because we like these movies. But I think what they're responding to is the aesthetic. And it's also, this term is new because a bunch of them happened at once. It's not new for there to be every once in a while a horror movie that is deemed respectable. There's Silence of the Lambs, Rosemary's Baby, a movie that came up when I was Googling this a couple times is Jacob's Ladder, a movie that I love, actually.
Did Silence of the Lambs come up in some lists of this?
No, I'm saying that if the term existed in 1991 or 1990, whatever year that was.
So that's an interesting, because that movie is playing very hard with the mechanics of suspense.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something you... I think the number one thing that it's like the biggest signifier to me of like this person's a snobby quote unquote horror fan is when someone smugly is dismissive of the idea of quote unquote jump scares. And it's like, oh, you mean one of the mechanics of horror? Like jump scares are great. Like, I mentioned Ty West in the sort of like proto elevated horror era, but The Innkeeper, starring our friend Pat Healy, is one of my favorite horror movies of the last decade, and that's full of like, oh no, it's just a cat, but it's still like, it's fucking scary in the moment, you know, you jump out of your seat. That's part of the fun of the suspense that you talk about in just watching horror movies and not wanting that. I think like you were saying, like not wanting to feel manipulated is part of the, that's why I go back to calling these movies, it's because certain types of audience feel safer in these movies than they do in less respectable forms of horror. And that goes to, I feel bad, Dallas, you and I were both very liberal people, but I feel like I'm going to spend a lot of time bagging on liberals.
Don't call me a liberal. Yeah. Nag away, bro.
But like, I think there's some, you know, one of my least favorite things, it happens every year around this time with the fall movie season, the awards movies, there'll always be a handful of movies that are like issue movies that are so superficial and so cynical and so like flattering to the audience. Like Boy Erased a few years ago is a movie that's like, yes, I absolutely agree with what this movie is saying, and I'm insulted by the way that it is trying to make me feel good about agreeing with it. And I feel like that's something about, like, Tyler, you and I have talked on the show before, a lot of horror movies, especially a lot of slasher movies, actually have kind of conservative moral values to them. And so I think, Dallas, you invoked the New Yorker type of audience. The New Yorker NPR type of audience likes the elevated horror movies because they're not challenging in a political or moral sense.
Oh, I think that's a great analysis there. I think that is, that's one of the things that's always made horror interesting. It's how, I don't want to call it I don't think of it as a reactionary genre, but definitely there's that streak of Puritanism. It's within slashers. I mean, that's so clear and so obvious, but, I was going to say something interesting. Oh, you know what you made me think of? I just have to get it onto the tape here.
Yeah.
That wonderful Kids in the Hall sketch where they're at the Oscars. Do you remember this one?
Go ahead.
So there's the guy, it's all these different performances at the Oscars. And one of them is all these different protests. So it's the climaxes of films and they're all up for best actor. And so it's a guy in a wheelchair and they're all the people that are super excited because the local bump manufacturer is getting a deal with the mayor, and the guy with the wheelchair rolls up to, and there's another one about, there's a whole group of people who are just, they don't like deaf people. And so they're all protesting deaf people. And I can't remember if it was Kevin Spacey. Oh, not Kevin Spacey. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Kevin or Mark, yeah. but who, Kevin McDonald, thank you. Anyway, sorry, this is the wrong direction, but everyone should Google, if you haven't seen that Kids in the Hall sketch, just Google it because it's delightful and I'm doing it no justice. But it's the kind of movie that you're talking about. They're just hollow movies that are, they talk about manipulative. I mean, they are products, and they're products to make you feel like you are on the correct side of issues.
And I do think that it's, I think, and Dallas, I think you had mentioned this and I agree. And I mean, it feels like we're just like ragging on people, but you know what? I'm okay with it because obviously the three of us are better than the people we're talking about. but I do think that there is this idea. I really like the idea, Dallas, of people not wanting to feel manipulated, or rather not wanting to validate that as art having any kind of artistic merit. Meanwhile, like, it's something that as I've gotten older and as I've become a teacher, something that I try to emphasize is like, obviously the term manipulation when talking about like one person to another, we don't like that. We don't, and understandably so, because there's just so much scheming going on behind it. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, it's like, but film and art in general, it's trying to get you to think a certain thing or feel a certain thing without simply saying you should think or feel this. Like if someone says you should feel this, that's the exact opposite of manipulation. But like through story and style, they're trying to get you to feel that thing. That is inherently manipulation. And that's not a bad thing. It's also an equalizer, you know, like if you're watching Jaws and Ben Gardner's head pops out of that little hole, and Hooper freaks out,
like the high-minded intellectual, you know, critic-minded audience member will jump just as much as the lowly, I've seen maybe five movies in my entire life person. And in that moment, like, they're the same. And if you're somebody who tries to think of film as a higher thing, or as a genuine art form, you're like, well, I can't intellectualize this. I can talk about the choices that the director made in order to get this response from me. But unlike something like Get Out, where I can really delve into things and appreciate it on a purely intellectual level, this forces me to acknowledge my own feelings. And I'd rather not do that because feelings are more irrational. They can't be trusted, whatever it is. And meanwhile, you know, I go back to something that Gene Siskel said when he talked about being a writer. He said, I approach a movie review as though I were just reporting a news story, but the news story is my reaction to the film, not even the film itself. And in that, and he says, like, if you laugh, say you laughed. If you screamed, say you screamed. And I think a lot of people don't want to do that. I think they want to hold themselves at a remove so that they can say, like, yes, I reacted to this, but I reacted based on who I am as an intellectual, as opposed to who I am as a person. And obviously I'm kind of playing armchair psychologist here. But I think, honestly, I think some of this comes from the fact that I myself have done this. I've been this. I think when I was younger and when, you know, when you start taking film seriously as an art form, you want to believe that you are better than the normies, as we call them. And it's like, you're not better. You might have a deeper appreciation, but when it comes right down to it, if something makes you laugh or something makes you scream, that's universal. And that's something to be embraced and something to be applauded, not something to be sort of looked at scornfully.
I think there's a particular self-consciousness that comes with being a high-minded fan of an art form that is also a very low and vulgar art form. Sure. there is this chip on our shoulders to constantly like prove to ourselves and to others that like, no, we appreciate cinema on a different level than the families who were going to the Cineplex on Friday night. And so there is this sort of knee-jerk dismissiveness. I certainly went through that period younger in my cinephile days of being like, being precious about when I use the word film and when I use the word movie. That was like a teenage me thing to do. And you kind of have to like go through that. I think, I mean, maybe not everyone does, you know, if you were born a grounded and self-actualized cinephile, then good for you. But a lot of us have to go through that period of like being kind of snobs to get to a point where we can say like, oh no, I like cinema and fucking, you know, the Friday the 13th is just as much cinema as, you know, Persona or whatever. It's all cinema.
Yeah. Yeah. Or Friday or The Witch, like Friday 13th or Nightmare on Elm Street is right. You can discuss them different ways. I something that was discussed a moment ago that it got me thinking, I think this is the right way to start approaching the ability to heal, from this terrible term, which the term is divisive. And so it comes down to something you were saying a moment ago, Tyler, that got me just thinking about how in general, we all, our first instinct is to approach things in a binary way, to say it's this or this. And so take like in lefty politics, it's a constant discussion. It's a race or class. And if you go deep into lefty stuff, nobody wants to talk about race because it's all class. It's all materialism. It's all class. But the truth is that it's both. So I'm I spend most of my time, if it's not in horror stuff and political stuff, and it bothers me to no end that we can't just go, hey, it's both. It's race and class. Those are the things we got to be dealing with here. So same thing with we're talking about is if a movie is, like take a Hitchcock movie. Now, of course, we can get deep into Hitchcock. We can get in, we bring Freud and Lacan and all this stuff in. But let's just put that to the side for a moment and just say we're approaching Hitchcock as formal mechanics only. So that is just as valid as then taking this European art film, or in this case, a quote unquote elevated horror film, and looking at it not with the distance, its formal mechanics have pushed us to have a bit of a distance. And that's meant to allow us then to think deeper about it, or quote unquote deeper about it, in a way that's beyond its mechanics, beyond its affectations. So I guess what I'm getting at is that it can just be both. We don't have to say, oh, I don't like movies that quote unquote manipulate me. And to put a cap on them, I think a better way to think about, to replace the word manipulate, I would just use it with a pursuit, describing a pursuit of clarity. I think when we feel manipulated, it's because the director, the film has successfully touched us with its clarity. And it achieved everything it wanted to do in that moment. That's a perfectly valid way to appreciate a film. To bring it back to Hitchcock again, what we can do with Hitchcock is take both sides of this equation and put it into one film. So you can watch Psycho and you can just watch it and enjoy the hell out of it for all of its mechanics and the way it's put together formally. And that's intellectually stimulating. And then you can go watch The Pervert's Guide to Cinema and bring Zizek into it. And you can take a whole nother dive into it with all this other psychoanalysis. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that it can just be both. Like, there's just no reason to have this divide between is something that is quote, that is making me scared on purpose, that's making me laugh, that is focused on its formal elements as the piece of as the intellectual. The intellectual gift to us is its formal mechanics. And then you have this other side where the intellectual gift to us isn't, where it's pushed us to a distance and allowed us to approach it with an art, quote, you know, artistic mind to begin with. Sorry, that was a big ramble, but I just feel also, like it's both.
Yeah, you don't need to apologize. Yeah.
And also speaking as someone who is frequently frustrated with, like, you know, the way, like, my fellow conservatives talk about film in general, I'd say, film specifically, they will talk about, like, any kind of movie that is not as straightforward, is not as straightforward as, you know, a Marvel film or something like that. And they'll say, like, movies are entertainment. They're supposed to entertain us. And, you know, I think, when I was younger, I pushed back and I overcorrected. I think I said, no, film is an art form. And thus I wound up going so far that I would diminish the concept of entertainment. And in actuality, it is both. And what's interesting is, like, a movie that is first off, even if a film is merely attempting to entertain, it's still going to be a product of its time. It's still going to be a product of its director. So it's still going to be doing a lot, whether it means to or not. But even so, like, the choices that are being made, whether it be from a narrative standpoint or a cinematography standpoint, music, whatever it is, all of those are inherently artistic decisions, all so that you can get a certain reaction out of the audience. And that's art. So even art, even entertainment is art. And course, then yeah. Art itself could be seen as entertainment, depending on how you define the word entertainment. And so, yeah, this idea of it being either or, and it's just like, well, I'm, you know, I would never deal with that Friday the 13th claptrap. I'm more of an It Follows guy. Mm-hmm. And she's like, well, if one works for you and one doesn't, that's fine. I wouldn't begrudge somebody having a negative reaction to 80s slasher movies. I'm not a big fan of them myself, but to downplay those as though. And even though the first Friday the 13th, the director specifically says, I was trying to rip off Halloween. Like he says it. And it's like, you can, and so it's like, okay, so you're not trying to really get at something here, but at the same time, you still have to make the same stylistic decisions that John Carpenter had to make for Halloween in order for it to be effective. And so whether you were trying or not, you're still making artistic decisions. And we as film people can act as though the director's initial intention is everything and not, and just dismiss whatever decisions they're making. Or we can say it's all part of it. Everything is, it's all of a piece. It's all the same thing. And we can, and every movie can be approached with, like, excitement and vigor and yes, intellectual analysis, while also tuning into our own emotions and seeing what the film got out of us in that regard. And it doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be both. And often it's not more, it's not only two things. It's a whole spectrum of things.
Sure.
You said something about like, you know, every movie or whatever. There's one more point that I want to get to. I know, I don't know how close we are to wrapping up. I know we've been going for like an hour. I wanted to turn the tables a little because I've spent so much time insulting people who gravitate toward quote unquote elevated horror. I want to turn the tables the other way against the purists. Cause I know, look, Dallas, I'm looking over your shoulder. I see the High on Fire poster. I know I know you're a metal guy. I'm something of a metal guy. But one thing I hate is the sort of like, if you're not now, you never were mentality of like, Mastodon aren't really metal anymore. So they're no longer true. They're no longer cult or whatever.
I just ran into that where I was wearing a Mastodon shirt and I just ran into that recently with a really nice young man who has given me all kinds of great suggestions for some metal bands to listen to, but was just not into the Mastodon shirt. And you know, that's your loss, dude. Mastodon's awesome.
And so I would also, chide people who say that these films aren't quote unquote real horror. They're real horror too. Like it follows. And I think part to talk about the Mastodon thing about how like as Mastodon has evolved as a band, they become more of this sort of like heavy bluesy hard rock band than metal. Like the fact that like David Robert Mitchell follows up, it follows with Under the Silver Lake, Jennifer Kent. Jesus, Jennifer Kent follows up the Babadook with the Nightingale, like non-horror movies, although both movies have horrific things in them, especially the Nightingale. Like the idea that somehow proves like, they're not real horror, because look at what they, once they got a bit of respectability, they moved on to something outside the genre. That doesn't make the Babadook any less horrific.
Yeah. I was on set a long time ago with this old school threat. It was a grip. He was older than me and was like real, like old school thrash metal guy. But super pure, super pure. And then we were talking about, I think Cannibal Corpse or something, but, we were talking about Norwegian. We got into a conversation about Norwegian black metal and I was just like, oh man, do you listen to Death Heaven? And he looked at me with such disdain.
Like
this guy, you know, he just, for him, that's just hipster bullshit. My thought was like, you're missing out, you know, like this is some of the best stuff happening right now and you're missing out. And so I guess my answer to like both camps in this divide, cause you're right. There's a lot of horror people that view the so-called elevated horror movies that view them with disdain, and they're missing out. The elevated horror people that are missing out by not engaging in some actual fun.
Yeah. What do you think of that most recent Death Heaven album though? That's not, cause it's no longer metal at all. Really? I mean, I guess it has some like,
don't know riffs. If I've listened to it.
Okay. It's good, but like I kept having to like, try not to think about who Death Heaven were while listening to it and just like treat it as its own thing. Cause it is a good album, but it's so far from black metal that like,
So the last thing I heard from them was Black Brick, that single. So I haven't listened to the new one. Speaking of bands that evolve, do you listen to Lantlos?
Oh, I've heard of Lantlos.
That is my current very favorite metal band. Sorry. Quick metal digression.
Yeah.
Amazing band from Germany. When they started the first record, just like real pure black metal coming from the deepest, darkest forests. And then their next record is like, you know, that 80s band Talk Talk. So every song, everything that Talk Talk did, not counting It's My Life. Okay. So put that to the side, everything else Talk Talk did. Imagine that combined with black metal and you've got the second Lantlos record and it's phenomenal. And then their next record is just like moving slowly into shoegaze via Jesu kind of thing. And their newest record is like really just like kind of upbeat hardcore slash shoegazy. And it's just fucking great. But you got to be along for the whole ride,
okay,
to enjoy it. Anyway, my recommendation is Lantlos.
I'll throw out a Russian atmospheric black metal band called Olhava, Olhava. I don't know if you've listened to them. The most recent
Haven't.
It's called Frozen Bloom.
Yeah, okay,
that's maybe the, well, it's certainly the atmospheric black metal record of the year for me.
Okay. Wait, say it again.
The band is Olhava, Olhava.
Okay.
And the newest album is Frozen
Bloom.
But to
bring it full circle to explain some real street cred here, but then I will then go on to say the other day, I out of the blue played some Megadeth and I was like, fucking A, Megadeth's great. I completely hadn't listened to Megadeth since I was 6 years old and was like, this is great. And so, you know, you got to get to a point in life where you just stop saying no to stuff. And horror movies, I think our message to horror people out there, to these two different camps, just cut it out. Like, The Witch is awesome and Friday the 13th is awesome. And maybe one or the other is actually not your cup of tea, and that's fine. But don't dismiss it because of you think something's pretentious or you think something is not pretentious enough, whichever it is that.
Right. That I think is one thing that I wanted to emphasize, is that like, there's no rule that says you have to like everything.
Correct.
But it's the dismissal. It's the fact of like, well, that I've heard about that, and you know what, that's not real horror. So thus I'm not going to watch it. Or it is also possible to watch something with your arms folded and not really giving it a chance. And that
not giving it a chance. That's exactly right. Yeah.
And that can happen either way, in either direction. And so it really is just, it goes back as always to sort of this gatekeeper attitude of this isn't real, that. And so I'm not going to give it a try, or if I do, I'm not really going to give it a try. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where you, like, when it comes right down to it, like, yeah, you're shutting yourself off from something that could be potentially really fun, or something that could be, or something that could be like really thought provoking, often maybe the same thing. But yeah, I think, as I have gotten older and I've really come to appreciate what horror is, I don't like everything. Some stuff I find to be in poor taste, which is frankly a term that I use less and less as I get older. But at the same time, I feel like, you know, Dallas, you don't know this, but David and the listeners do. This week, there's a documentary coming out directed by me called Valley of the Shadow, The Spiritual Value of Horror. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes. People can you can either subscribe to Rediscover Television and watch it that way, or you can rent it directly Vimeo on demand. It will be available sometime this week. I don't remember, either Monday or Tuesday. I'll certainly put out a lot of announcements.
Yes, this sounds great.
The point is, If you told me 10 years ago that I was going to be devoting a significant portion of my time to making this documentary, I would have definitely scoffed a little bit and wondered, like, what on earth, what am I going to say? Because even 10 years ago, I mean, I still loved horror, but I don't think I was still fully open to it as I am now. And I have no doubt there will be plenty of people, because it is sort of intended for a Christian audience. Gets pretty churchy at the end, just a heads up, everybody. But I know there will be some people who just instinctively are not going to want to do it. Mm-hmm. I believe, because the guy who runs the streaming service that paid for this, he's very much on board, so much so that in anticipation of it, he started posting some like classic horror movies on the streaming service, and I think as a result he lost some subscribers.
Oh man.
So you know, that's unfortunate, but at the same time, like, it's not uncommon. And so I do think that it's such a beautiful, maybe not in the traditional sense of the word, it's such a beautiful genre that can do so much. And David, I think you've said this before, that it might be the most inherently cinematic genres. Mm-hmm.
I've said that before, but then like I also think about action, so like those two together, horror and action, as far as genre filmmaking go, are maybe the most pure cinema.
Have you done an episode like a why horror episode, like why it matters?
I don't think so. I think that's
so big.
Sounds like next year's Halloween episode.
Can I call dibs on it?
Yeah, next year's Halloween episode.
Okay, well, I'm going to watch this documentary first because I feel like there's going to be some good stuff in there to bring to the table.
Maybe.
And I can just rent it on iTunes
or Apple. It'll be through Vimeo, which is available on various.
Oh, Vimeo. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, well, I'll tweet out links to it and all that sort of thing.
Well, I can't wait to see it. And I would like to then take what we're discussing now. So full disclosure, I have some people from LA that just drove up. So I'm going to have to wrap up, but, I feel like this is a starting place to a conversation. Maybe we should reapproach in a couple months. I'm not trying to horn in here, but if you wanted to and like move into something about horror that's a little bit broader, just why it's even here, why we engage in horror at all.
And why it's like from the moment film started, horror was there. Like that's worth noting, I think. But anyway, I'm all in favor of it. But Dallas, as you know, as a longtime listener, we don't let the guests dictate what we do. We steer this shit.
Okay? Open you up to new ways of being.
That's exactly what you've done here. Thank you for being here, Dallas. This is a great conversation.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it very much.
Meanwhile, you can find us at battleshipretention.com. You can email us at david@battleshipretention.com or tyler@battleshipretention.com. You can follow me on Twitter @DaveyPretension. Also, make sure to check out my other podcast, which is called The One Where I Met Your Mother, in which my wife and I watch an episode of Friends, an episode of How I Met Your Mother every week, and compare and contrast. And we also talk the music of the era and the fashion of the era and what else was going on. It's fun and sometimes it gets a little heady, but then also we, you know, make fun of Chandler's vest or whatever. So I don't even remember what happened. Rachel hooks back up with the guy she left at the altar and Marshall and Lily try to plan a wedding on 2 months' notice. Those are the two episodes we watched. You can follow Tyler on Twitter @TylerPretension. Tyler, what do you have to plug other than your documentary for which this entire episode was stealthily a commercial?
I'm glad that you picked up on that. Speaking of manipulation. That's basically it. And again, it's as of we're recording this same day that it's going up.
Hey, it'll go late tonight, early tomorrow.
Roughly, yeah.
Again, officially, I know I tend to put up episodes Sunday night. Officially, our drop date is Monday.
Sure.
Because I never want people to expect they can listen to Battleship Retention on the way to church or whatever. It's really Monday.
Nothing gets me going when I'm headed to church more than this type of conversation. So it'll be available sometime this week, probably Tuesday or Wednesday. We wanted it a little bit before Halloween. That'll definitely be happening. But we're putting some finishing touches on it right now, and it'll be available very soon.
Dallas, do you have anything you want to plug, or where can people find you?
No, I'm not on Twitter.
Good for you.
On Instagram, but I have nothing new to plug. Lots of irons in the fire. Hopefully I'll have something to plug in the next year or so.
All right.
Exciting. Okay. We can't wait to have you back. Thanks again for being here, Dallas. Thank you everyone at home for listening.
We'll get you next time.
Bye.
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 This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.